You're listening to the STC Sheffield podcast. Our sermon series in the morning is Meet God, and in the evening we'll be travelling through the Book of Acts and Paul's letters in our This Is Church series.
My name is Bryony, and I'm on the staff team here, and it's great to be speaking to you this morning. This year, we're going through the Meet God series in the morning gatherings, and we're looking at the person of Jesus through the lens of John's Gospel. And we're asking the question, really, how can we meet God through the person of Jesus? What can we find out about God as we see how Jesus lived and interacted with those around him? If you cast your mind back to last week, Mick shared a message on Jesus and the Spirit and looked through chapter 7 of John's Gospel, and we looked at what it is to have a life that overflows, what it is to be full of the Spirit, and what would it look like if we were people that had that complete overflow and overspill of the Spirit in our everyday lives. Today, it's a slightly different tact. We're looking at the topic of Jesus and forgiveness. So it'd be handy if you can turn to the chapter 8 in John's Gospel, which is on page 1073 of your books. That would be handy to have that ready. I really want to look today at the person of Jesus and whether he condemns or compels us. That's the thing we're going to look at, is are we condemned or compelled? And we're going to look at this as we consider chapter 8 of John's Gospel. Now, chapter 8 is a bit of a funny passage, and the passage I'm looking at is verses 1 to 11. And you can see in your blue Bibles that in some copies of the Bible, this isn't even included. But I think this passage helps us actually put chapter 8 and the rest of what we're going to look at this year into some context. The chapter here begins with a group of religious leaders, the Pharisees, wanting to stone a woman. And that's the story that we're going to read in a few minutes. And it finishes in verse 59 with them wanting to stone Jesus himself. And what happens in between these two stories is that Jesus actually starts to say some pretty harsh things to the Pharisees. And even at one point, he calls them children of the devil. And that might, at first reading, sound pretty harsh, a bit extreme. But when we include this story at the beginning of chapter 8, we really start to see, and we get to the heart of the problem of the human heart, the problem with the Pharisees. What is the problem with their attitude? And why Jesus becomes more firm? What is it that Jesus is trying to root out of these people? So let's just get into this and read this bit of scripture. So I'm reading from chapter 8, starting at verse 1. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Then he stooped down and began to write on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." So a woman has been dragged in front of Jesus, accused of adultery. The leaders are clearly using this woman to attack Jesus himself. it seems that they're really not that bothered about what she's done, because if they were, the law also requires that they bring the man out as well in front of the community, and they haven't done that. What they're simply doing is using this woman as a prop in their trap. And the trap is simple, really. If Jesus says that she should be stoned, then he is committing treason against Rome, who were the ruling authority, and they didn't permit execution for adultery. So he'd be committing treason. But what the Pharisees are hoping for, knowing what they know about Jesus, is that he will say that her sins are forgiven. And that would go against the law of Moses, which specified that the stoning should happen, as horrific as that is. They wanted to trap him in this impossible conundrum, because they cannot or will not believe that God's forgiveness is available for this woman. And they even have this law to back them up. You see, they want punishment. They like the law because it guarantees punishment and justice. She has done something wrong and she should pay. And I want to pause here because I find that kind of tricky, and not because I disagree with justice or punishment. I think for a lot of us, punishment actually makes quite a lot of sense. You know, we'd say you do the crime, you do the time. It's a phrase that we use in our culture. That's why compensation companies are so prolific, why people want to know that when someone has done something wrong, somebody will pay. That's why the press hound CEOs out of failing organisations when something goes wrong. We would rather that somebody pays. Somebody needs to receive a punishment when something goes wrong. And partly, that's because many of us have a really strong sense of justice. I have two younger brothers, Dan and Tan, Tom and Dan, there we go. And there's, Tom is the youngest, and I'm 7 years older than him, and Dan is 5 years older. And I remember one vivid instance where, on the way home from secondary school, Tom, our youngest brother, encountered some bullies and got into like a fight. And he is just such a pacifist. And he got home and kind of was telling my dad about this story. And Dan, who is not as calm an individual, just mixed laughing because he knows him. And my brother is not as quite as placid as my younger brother. I'm not going to say where I sit on the spectrum. But he got home and Dan was so incensed that somebody had done this to his younger brother. He was so angry. And it was all that my dad could do to physically restrain him from running down the road to chase these kids. And that happened many times in our childhood, that Dan was restrained from going to kind of do his own vigilante thing on our street in Hull and go and get boys that had dared to touch his younger brother. And I was thinking about that and like Dan's real sense of right and wrong and justice and whether that reaction is wrong. And well, no, in many ways, because actually that need for justice is actually God-given. God is just. He hates sin and the places where the world falls short of his plans and his purposes. But you see, the problem here is that what we are witnessing isn't a genuine need for justice. The Pharisees are using these laws to help them wield power. And it is into this challenging question about how justice is done that Jesus speaks. Faced with this trap, Jesus says, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." This, at the surface level, seems like quite a risky strategy, because he has left it open for anybody to pick up a stone. But of course, no one does. In this simple reply, Jesus is really saying, the law isn't wrong. But if we are serious about it, we are all guilty. Of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus will expand on this particular law and say that even looking at someone lustfully is committing a sin. And the crowd here certainly get the point, because one by one, they drop their stones and they walk away until finally this woman is left alone with Jesus. As an aside, I think it's really interesting that it's included in this text that the older men drop their stones first. And for me, that was a little reminder to us that who are younger to respect the wisdom of those who have more experience. You can picture these young, hot-headed men standing there with their stones ready to stone this woman. And yet it's the older men who realise much more quickly that they are in no place to cast the first stone. One by one, they realise the challenge in what Jesus has said. And so this woman is left alone. And you can just imagine it, can't you? She can barely believe that she has escaped. You can imagine her trembling on the floor as she hears the pairs of feet walking away. She looks up to Jesus, and I wonder what was going on. What was the emotions that was in her heart and her mind at that time? Gratitude, fear, relief, maybe a question about what Jesus is going to do next, maybe surprise. Maybe it was just an overwhelming mix of all of those things. And Jesus stands and addresses her. "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she says, "No one, sir." And his reply, "Then neither do I condemn you." So remember that Jesus has told the crowd that if anyone hadn't sinned, they could stone her. That means that legitimately he himself is the only one with the right to stone her. He's the only one who could have thrown a stone. Jesus was without sins. The gospel is clear about that and tells us time and time again that he was without blemish or transgression, that he was clean and pure. So he isn't not condemning her because he doesn't have the right to. In fact, he has the right to. He is the only one with the right to. He is not condemning her because he is choosing to offer forgiveness instead. And just imagine the relief of that woman. In this moment, Jesus completely sets her free. He offers her this free gift of forgiveness. Maybe today we need to hear those words, "I do not condemn you." Maybe we need to accept forgiveness. And we can spend a lot of time, not necessarily condemned by others, but condemned by ourselves. If you've ever thought, "I'm a terrible parent," or "I'll never be able to do this right," or "I'm sure I'll never change." It's like you're stood there holding the stone, ready to condemn yourself. To those of us who think like that, Jesus is longing for us to hear those words, "I do not condemn you." And I know that because I know that to be true for myself. When I was 19 years old, I got engaged to a man that I was very much in love with. But a few months down the road, I realised that it was not the right thing for me and that I shouldn't be getting married. The complication was that at this point I was in France and my fiancé was in England. But I broke off that engagement and then spent the whole summer that I was away, it was 3 months, completely consumed by guilt. Even though I knew that that was the right thing to do, the pain that I'd caused, just I couldn't escape that. I could think about the people, the family that my decision was affecting. And I really struggled to believe that they would ever forgive me, let alone that God could look at me in the same way again. And I returned from my time abroad just feeling just that overwhelming sense of grief and of guilt. Until one night I was in a prayer meeting at the university that I was part of, and somebody was praying about the passage where the disciples asked Jesus, "How many times should we forgive?" And he replies by saying 70 times 7. And as somebody read out that verse, something fell from my Bible, and it was the ticket stub from my flight out from at the beginning of the summer. And I looked at it, and I'd been sat on seat number 77. And in that moment, I felt like God said, "I had forgiven you before you even got on the plane, before you were eaten up by guilt, before you'd even done anything, you stood forgiven." God wasn't and isn't condemning me. Maybe today you need to know that. You need to know that God isn't condemning you. In fact, he is loving you into the kingdom and more into the life that he has for you. Grace is hard for us because deep down, like I said earlier, most of us found justice an easier concept to grasp. That you do something wrong, you pay the price. Grace says you do something wrong, you don't pay the price. Grace is hard for us. It is way easier to condone ourselves and others because grace means that we have to forgive, that we have to let go. Jesus offers extreme forgiveness to this woman, but he doesn't leave it there. Jesus' final words to the woman are, "Go now and leave your life of sin." Forgiveness isn't the same as tolerance. Forgiveness doesn't say, carry on in the same direction that you were going. Sin matters. It mattered in the life of this woman. Jesus isn't condemning her, but neither is he condoning her choices. His challenge to her is to live a life by the forgiveness that she's received, to live in light of the forgiveness she has received from Jesus. Remember that when this woman was brought before Jesus, she expected to die. When she stood there before Jesus, she thought, this is it, this is the end for me. She has literally been granted a second go at life, a second chance. And Jesus' challenge is that she walks into that new life, that she walks differently. Life will be different from this point forward. This woman has experienced extreme grace and forgiveness from Jesus. He has accepted her, and now he calls her up to be more than she is, to live fully and to live as he intends. When we experience that amazing grace and forgiveness that Jesus offers, we long to respond with our whole lives, and we glimpse that grace and his love, then we are not condemned, but we are compelled to live differently. We can't help but respond like that when we understand it properly in our hearts. I'm going to show a short video now, which Mick showed us in one of our meetings last week, that just really spoke to my heart about this. And it just beautifully demonstrates the effect of that kind of forgiveness on a person. So we're just going to turn the lights down now and just watch this for 3 minutes. It's quite hard to follow that. But that video is a demonstration of forgiveness and love that brings not condemnation, but compelled that man to change. And in so many ways, we are all like him. We are all so aware of the places that we are not walking in step with God's desires and God's heart for us. And yet God's love compels us to change. It compels us to live differently. And in light of God's forgiveness and acceptance, we realise that justice actually has been served, that someone has been punished. It just wasn't us. It was God's own son on the cross. Jesus goes to the cross so that the price of us walking away from God is paid. When we understand that, when we realise that he was the one who took the condemnation so that we are not condemned, the only correct response to that kind of amazing grace and love is to be compelled to be different, to live differently. Not because we have to, but because we want to. Because it's the worship of a heart that is overflowing, just like Mick talked about last week, that we are overflowing with his love and his forgiveness and his spirit, that it is the reaction that we just have to live differently. So maybe today you need to take heart the truth that no one, not even yourself, should condemn you. No matter how much we slip and fail and repeat the same mistakes, God's love for us is everlasting. And the outworking of this, of course, is that we will be more loving. Once you know how blessed you are to receive grace, it is easier to be gentle with others, to offer the same to them. And if I'm honest, I find that quite challenging, quite hard, because I also share my brother's deep sense of justice and right and wrong. And I've been reading a book recently that's been taking me through the Psalms every day. And it is amazing how many of the Psalms are about God's people telling God that he needs to act, that God needs to do something because of the bad things that are happening to them and to the world around them, that it needs sorting out. However, at the end of many of those psalms is an admission that God is God, that it is not my place to judge, that I need to leave it to God. And that is a hard thing to do, to walk away from a situation, maybe when someone has hurt you and they haven't even said sorry. But understanding forgiveness and the love that you've been shown enables you, it compels you to put down those needs. I was really challenged a few years ago that whenever me and Rich would argue, which of course is hardly ever, but whenever we did have any disagreement, Rich is my husband, you need to know that for this to make sense, that every time that we argued, regardless of who was in the wrong, often we would come back to talk about it, because I would stew, because I'm a proper introvert, so I would stew for as long as was to make him feel awful. And then we would kind of have a conversation, and often I would say sorry. But if Rich, and it often probably because it was my fault, but then if Rich didn't say sorry, I'd be really annoyed. Because actually I'd walked into that conversation, I walked into that discussion about our marriage, waiting for him to apologise. And when I said sorry, I hadn't really said sorry, because it was a sorry with conditions. It was a I'm sorry as long as you are too. And I was really challenged, there's lots of nodding, this is good. I was really challenged to get to a point of forgiveness and then go into the conversation. To be at a point that I was like, I have totally forgiven you for this stuff, and I'm sorry for the bits that I have done as well, and I don't need you to say sorry to me. And that is really hard, and it still challenges me. We've been together 10 years, and it is still the thing that I find really difficult. But to actually go into those conversations going, no, I have forgiven you. I don't need you to say sorry. I mean, look, he does say sorry. I'm paying him to be like, he just never says sorry. He does say sorry. But I'd felt really challenged about that, because what I was really thinking in those conversations is, if he doesn't say sorry, then I'm taking my sorry back. And actually, it sounds funny, but that's not the gospel. That's not the gospel. God has given us forgiveness with no strings attached. With no strings attached. God forgives us before we even ask for forgiveness. That is the gospel. And so when I do that with Rich, I'm not modeling the gospel. I'm not modeling Jesus to him. I'm modeling some other thing that is very much not Jesus. I'm going to invite the band up, because they're going to just sing now a song over us before we do our final song. And it's a song called Ever Be. And I've been thinking a lot about this week as I've been preparing. Because I wanted them to sing it to us, because really it is a song that talks about what Jesus has done in forgiving us and how we respond. The words of the second verse say, "You father the orphan, your kindness makes us whole. You shoulder our weakness and your strength becomes our own. Now you're making me like you, clothing me in white, bringing beauty from ashes, for you will have your bride. Free of all her guilt and rid of all her shame, and known by her true name, and it's why I sing." Jesus has offered us forgiveness. He has made us right with God, and because of that, we are compelled to sing. We are compelled to live lives that are different, lives that are punctuated by songs of praise and worship, lives that are called to live as worship, free of all guilt and rid of all shame.